Accession number 12709, Mr. Albert Davis, Reel 17.
Mr. Albert Davis, Reel 17. How severe was the fighting at Geel, Mr. Davis?
Well, in my opinion, it was all mixed up and one of the severest battles of the whole campaign. It's much worse than the landing, because we'd bypassed Germans and they were all around us, back, sides, front. And every step you took, you almost bumped into a German, which most of them were surrendered. You either shot them or they surrendered. But it was very mixed up. You didn't know where they were coming from. Personally, most of them were well under the ground in well camouflaged trenches, which you couldn't see. You would just walk over the top and then they'd get up after you'd passed from behind. If nobody was following up, they got a good chance of mowing you down from behind. But it was really severe. Your nerves were on edge all the time. Ed was like spinning from side to side. Such, where are they coming from next?
Were the German tanks involved in this fighting?
Oh yes, tanks as well. And then they would be stationed in the tanks and then waiting until you passed almost. And then you'd look around, get within 50 yards of them, and then suddenly see a tank. Well, first thing is take cover and look around and see where was the nearest gun to knock it out. But by this time, the tanks were after bigger targets than the infantrymen. And I suppose they could have mowed us down 20 times, but somehow they didn't. We got away with it.
Was there a lot of men lost?
Quite a few, yeah, quite a few. And I think it's the only time the battalion HQ and division HQ got involved really in the fighting. They were even going past BHQ and brigade HQ. And then they realised what a mess it was in. It eventually finished all right anyway.
What happened to you after that?
After that we withdrew, had a slight rest, and then headed for the escort canal. Now, there we lay up, reformed again, ready for the next session, Market Garden. That's when the airborne paratroops landed, first at Grave Bridge, then at Nijmegen, and then at Arnhem. Our job was to follow on. I think we had about two stops that Jerry had cut the lines to mop up a few infantry soldiers. It held them up quite a bit because getting to Arnhem was vital and we couldn't get there fast enough. Personally, saying a bridge too far was too much, really. If they'd have gone as far as Nijmegen, in my opinion, and just stopped, reformed, they probably would have took Arnhem. But it was really too much to ask in the time, because you never know. I mean, one small company can hold up a battalion for probably days. It all depends on how fanatical they are. But we didn't have much trouble until we got to Nijmegen. Then, crossing the bridge at Nijmegen, we spread out and finished up a place called Bemmel, behind a big factory. There we took up defensive positions. Came out, had a few days rest, then back in again to a place called Elst, where we took up the defensive positions again, and did patrols continually. And it was very, very cold and nearly every day raining. Right, November.
What were the ground conditions like that you were living in?
Very wet. Well, we got in an old farmhouse or any place you could find, a bombed house. We always kept dry to sleep, but outside it was soggy, wet. There was one incident where we were in a cellar and I was observing, and I could see along a road, built up road, German head moving the side of the road. Apparently they got a trench looking right at us. And there was two Germans in this trench. I should say the distance would be 150, 200 yards away. 200 yards away. I watched them for quite a time, and then I went to the corporal, sniper corporal. I said, could you lend me your rifle a bit? He said, what for? I said, I just seen something I want to have a pot shot at. What is it? I said, I wouldn't tell him. He said, it must be good if you want a shot. Anyway, he wouldn't lose your rifle. He said, no, let's have a look, see what you... And I showed him, and just at that time as I was showing him, this one German got out of the trench, rolled down into the ditch, and he must have been took short. Of course, he dropped his trousers with his behind facing us, and I said, give us that rifle. And he said, no, he said, not on your life. He says, this is my shot. And I said, well, just tickle him a bit then. And he said, right, and bang. Of course, he threw up his arms and dropped face down in the ditch. And within 2 minutes, they must have had a telephone there, because within 2 minutes, two more German with a stretcher, Red Cross Germans, came running. Where they came from, or we don't know, we didn't see where they came from, came running across this field and picked him up. But a little later on, we scouted along the road, and they must have vacated the trench altogether, because the other one wasn't there. We waited and waited to see if he'd get out, but no way. But as soon as it got dark, he must have got out and scarpered back.
So the Germans weren't far away from you?
Oh no, not in some cases. They were extremely good at camouflage, you know, dug in, you know, and just left slits so that they could observe through it. And then sort of with a lid, you know, a piece of wood or something, they could lift it up and stick a wedge in it to fire when we got close.
Was it particularly difficult fighting in these conditions?
Well, I don't know whether it's difficult. It's it was a case of who sees who first. If you're lucky enough to spot him first, and then this is what you've got to do, is wait and wait and really, for the least movement of anything. And this is why we were doing a lot of patrols.
Were you involved in the patrols?
Yes. The worst patrol I ever did.
And what were they like?
It was a listening patrol. There was flared tripwires laid in front of a farmhouse at night. I went the night before the patrol got captured. Jerry captured it. So I had to go with three men, telephone line, and set out my men. It was atrocious weather, mizzling rain. It started at about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and I got to stay there until at least 8 o'clock the next morning. Anyway, off we set and gets to the farmhouse. But we're forbidden to go in the farmhouse. We've got to stay this side. The first thing I did was lay the telephone on and test it. That's all right. Cover that up from the rain with the ground sheet, and then set my men out. There's no trenches or no ditches to get into. They just had to lie on the bare ground. Set the men out about 15-20 yards apart with a Bren gun in the middle and a rifle on either side. And I would be in the rear another 20 yards with the telephone. But it was continually raining. It was and very cold. You could feel yourself shivering. It's the only time I ever drunk my rum ration. We did have a rum ration that night. And of course every hour or less I had to crawl to each man to make sure that he's awake and alert. That was all right. They phoned us up once or twice to ask us, all right, you know, okay. If you want any gunfire, put it down, just give us a ring. Anyway, come 12, around midnight, we could hear lots of treading in the muds, lots of movement. So we're all alerted, of course, ready to fire. But eventually we found out that it was a sow and eight little pigs that had kept us on our toes for probably a couple hours. 2 o'clock in the morning, one of the flares went up. As the flare went up, I could see this Alsatian dog. It was a dog that had set it off. Now, there must have been somebody around with that dog. So, they phoned up from HQ saying, what's going on with the front? What's going on? You know, a bit panicky fired. I said, nothing. I said, an Alsatian dog has just set up the flares. We'll put you down some gunfire. I said, no, one gunfire. He said, you're getting it anyway. And they started laying some artillery down. After that, it went, probably it was a good thing, because there's obviously German patrols there. We couldn't see them, didn't meet up with them, just the dog. But phoned back, said, it's all right, it's gone quiet again now. After that, it's gone, it went quiet again, and I said, well, you come back now. I said, no, I'll stay here till I'm relieved properly. Anyway, I stayed there till 8 o'clock. And by God, it's the last patrol I ever did, and the worst patrol. Not because of the fighting, but the conditions. Thick with mud. It took me half a day to get cleaned up. Thick with mud and bitterly cold and wet through. And the lads were the same. They were just lying there shivering. And this, the you've got to keep going to them to keep them awake and keep them mobile.
There was different types of patrols, was there not? This one you said was a listening patrol.
Yes.
What are the types of patrols would be going out?
Well, sometimes they'd send a fighting patrol out. Which would be bigger patrol, yeah. But most times it was just a listening patrol or observation. This was listening patrol, so that back at BHQ and some of the lads could get some sleep. But it was a warning, if you like. And the night before us, as I said, the patrol got captured. And that was through getting in a ditch and lighting up cigarettes, which is a foolish thing to do. I'm a smoker, but that particular night I had to give up the smoking. Well, in fact, I did sneak a smoke, but it was right in undercover, where not even I could see the cigarette end.
You were there some time. Do you recall the time of the year that you were in this position?
Yes, late October it was. Late October.
And there wasn't much movement in the attacking situation?
No, they were more or less static. And there was also another incident where I thought, well, this farmhouse, there was some artillery, two artillery officers there, and I was there on observation again, OP, maybe glasses, looking into Arnhem, or this side of the river, and anywhere. And I said to these officers, I said, well, you can't see much from down here, I said. You know, there isn't even a window yet that I'll look through. It's no good sitting downstairs trying to find out anything. I said, I'll go to see if I can make a hole in the roof of the old barn. I climbed the ladder, straw up in the old barn, and found an old rusty saw. I thought, oh, that'll do nicely. I'll cut a hole in the roof, just about 6 inches square. I thought, well, they won't see it, because it's a rusty saw, it won't glisten or anything. So I eventually act until I was through. But they must have had a damn good observation post, because they did see it, or they sensed something. Because I just got it finished, having a look around, or whether it would be poking me glasses so or not, I don't know. Just having a look around, and suddenly a shell dropped short. I ignored that. And then, about a minute later, shell went over the top. But the third one, smack on target. It hit the gable end of the house, of this barn, and it knocked me flying right down the loft, and I ended up alongside these officers on the lower ground. And of course, I got a rollicking for that. He says, you've bloody well upset our observation post. He says, for Christ's sake, piss off. So I said, right, I'll just do that. And, of course, they had to move, and so did I. I found another observation post a bit further away.
Were you still in command of your own guns at this time?
Yes, more or less, but I was after some, trying to find some good targets, you know. If I could, as I say, they were so well camouflaged, and it was difficult to spot anything. You got to concentrate on one spot quite a long time before you saw any movement. And Arnhem itself and the river was approximately 5 miles away. But the Germans had got a better view of us than what we had got of them, because they were higher up. Arnhem was higher than Elst. They were looking down on Elst. But you're always after something. It's no good to sit in there on your backside waiting. You've got to try and find targets if you could.
Did the conditions under which you were living and being active affecting the health of yourself and other people?
Well, I won't say it affected health. I know there's a lot of grumbling going on because it is wet and muddy, and they're glad to get out. But I can't tell whether it affected health or not.
Were you getting any leave opportunities?
Not then, no. Because come November, we were told that we were going to be withdrawn altogether, and the division was going back to England. Well, that was a big boost for everybody. And eventually in November we did get withdrawn and went back into Belgium and got disbanded. The younger elements, the younger recruits that came to join us were transferred to the 9th Battalion, because we kept one battalion, which was the 9th, to represent 50 Div to go through Germany and the end of the campaign. So all the young elements joined the 9th Battalion. But the veterans who had been fighting since the beginning of the war were all going back to England, excepting 5. And I was one of the 5. Sergeant Russ, Sergeant Foden, Sergeant Montgomery, and Sergeant Welsh were the other 4. Now, we were retained in Belgium and sent to RHU Louvain for the purpose of doing duties other than fighting. We were classed as war weary, or war veterans, if you like. I went to Louvain. We didn't like it there very much, because there was dozens and dozens of NCOs of all artillery, all sorts, all dressed up to the nines, walking about with bits of paper while we were doing all the duties. So we got fed up and told them so that we weren't going to do the duties until there was a fair roster made. No reason why they can't do duties as well as us. So I refused to do one duty, and so they transferred me then to the Dutch Brigade. I had to report to Schaaf HQ at Eindhoven, and then I sent Nicholas, I think it's St. Nicholas, and report to the Dutch Brigade. But they didn't tell me what I got to do. All as I knew that they were reforming the Princess Irene Brigade. And I was in the dark as to what my duties were there. Anyway, I knew they were reforming, so I presumed it was to liaison with the officers and get it reformed. Anyway, I was there about 3 or 4 weeks. And then they told me I got to report back to RHU Louvain, which I did. As soon as I got back, they put me on duty again, which I didn't do. So the very next day, they told me then that I'd got to report to St. Nicholas, number 2 training wing, Belgian brigade, which I did. These were a bit more pleasant to work with. They still didn't tell me my duties. And there was quite a few that could speak English, so we got on pretty well together. And I tagged along all right, we blended in, and went back over the Nijmegen Bridge with them, more or less scouting around. I never went into action with them. They never went into action at all. We withdrew from there and went back into Germany, to a place called Beckham. And I was there for quite a time. And we were getting on well with everybody excepting one officer. This one officer got something against me because I challenged his judgment. So he came to me, he said, Sergeant, you're well overdue for leave. He says, you've got to report back to Borg Leopold. I said, all right. Gets back to Borg Leopold, and they said they knew nothing about me. They didn't know I existed even. He'd done that on his own bat to get rid of me. Nevertheless, the officer at Borg Leopold said, well, your debob number's coming up very shortly, so it isn't worth going back into Germany. So we'll send you to Bruges, which I went to Bruges, to another mixed unit, and spent the rest of my time until my debob number came up.
And over all of these moves, you'd never really had a specific task to do?
No.
And how did you fill your time in? And did you just kind of help where you could?
Or? Oh, there was drills and odd regimental things to do, but nothing really specific. A lot of the time was leisure, really. Apart from lecture here and lecture there, and not really a lot of work. Well, they knew we were coming from a demob, so they didn't bother us so much.
Were you able to form an opinion on the quality of the Dutch and Belgian soldiers that you were with?
Well, the Dutch seemed all right. They were seen to be organising all right, so there was nothing to say there. You know, they're similar to ourselves. And in their case, I couldn't speak Dutch, and they couldn't speak English, a lot of them, so... But they seemed to be all right. The Belgian Brigade, I got on well with them. They're a bit slipshod in some things. Not so much discipline as we got. But then, I couldn't enforce discipline to them. But the Sergeant Major and the NCOs, everybody was great except in the one officer. And we really got on well.
What had you done to upset the officer?
Well, this particular officer, we'd already got billets. This particular French-speaking officer, he wanted this family to get out of the house. I forget how many was in the family, but he said he wanted it for a billet. Well, I knew he didn't want it for a billet. He didn't want it. He just took a dislike to that family. So the family a woman came to me and, being a British sergeant, thought perhaps she'd get more change out of me. Came to me and said, look, Sergeant, he's trying to get us out of our house. He wants it for a billet. We got nowhere else to go. So I went to the office, and after a lot of difficulty in talk, when I had to get one of the lads to translate it, I asked him why he wanted the house. And he says, nothing to do with you. I said, it's everything to do with me. I said, this family's approached me and asked for my help because the billet wasn't required. He says, I'm telling you, they've got to get out. So that got my back up. I said, well, I'm telling you, they stay. I said, I'm going to see the burgomaster. And I went to see the burgomaster, and he came down and made the situation up. Weighed up what billets we've got. He said, well, really, you've got more billets now than you require. There's two of them empty now. What do you want it for? And he couldn't give him a truthful answer. So he said, no, the family stays where it is. Well, after that, I was in his bad books.